Hello and welcome back to Planet Waves FM. My name is Eric Francis, your host, and broadcasting from the United Astrology Conference in St. Louis. What the hell's in St. Louis? Monsanto, I don't know, that big arch from New Orleans, Louisiana. That's St. Louis is far away from here. Anyway, continuing coverage, and my guest now is a gentleman named Kaushik Rajan. He's a professor of anthropology at the University of Chicago, is that correct? In Chicago, of course, originally from Madras in southern India. And he, for about 15 years, you said, have been studying biologists. So you're an anthropologist who's been studying scientists and learning what made them become scientists and how they think?
Yeah, and the context in which they work. The context in which they work.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what have you learned about biologists from doing this work?
Well, I've done a bunch of different projects on them. My first project was sort of looking at the politics of the Human Genome Project as it was unfolding, and what genomics means, both in terms of a new paradigm in biology, but also what it means in terms of changing ways of doing science, because a lot of the Genome Project was happening at a moment when biology was very rapidly becoming commercialized. And this was the height of the dot-com boom in Silicon Valley and so on and so forth. There were new companies that were coming up and trading in databases and making money out of them. So there was a question of both the changing knowledge base of biology, but also the changing institutional structures within which that was happening.
Right, and a lot more money coming from pharmaceutical companies, and then the increase of computing power made the unraveling of the genome possible. These computers couldn't go fast enough till fairly recently to uncover that, you know, to calculate that much data that's contained in the genome. There's a lot of data.
Well, one of the things that was really interesting is that this was a moment when biology was becoming informatic. And there was a particular moment in time where biology really did come to be, where important parts of biology came to be about data generation and data mining. I think that what that means has changed a lot over the last 15 years, because throughout the 90s, the question was, how do we get enough information and how do we get enough data? Very quickly, that question became, we have too much data and we don't know what to do with it. So it's become a problem of interpretation, organization, understanding the functions of things rather than just getting information about them.
And the need to use pattern recognition as a way of processing data. There needs to be new methods of processing
Absolutely. The
amount of data. And that sounds like it would embrace chaos theory.
It embraces a lot of different things depending on who you are, because there are so many subspecializations within biology. I mean, genome science is now not one thing. Pretty much any biologist is making use of genome science in his or her everyday practice.
When did they say they finished, crunching the whole thing and knowing what every gene is for?
Oh, they don't know what every gene is for. The working draft sequence was finished in 2000. And that's when they realized that, and that was the end of a project, a formal sort of state-funded project.
And where did that end up? In 2000, what did they have that they didn't have before?
What they had was a genetics, the sequence of the human genome, which is, what are the base pairs in the human genome? They had a bunch of bits and bytes, A, T, G, and C, and the order in which they existed. That's all they had. And then they had to figure out what that meant.
And they have to go basically gene by gene. They have to obviously unravel deeper in for specific purposes to find the exact chromosome that might cause a problem.
Well, not necessarily. There was a certain kind of linear story that was told during the sequencing project as if that is what the problem would be. But really, one of the things that the Genome Project threw up is the question of what is a gene? And that's not obvious. For one thing, it was found that human beings have far fewer genes than what many people thought.
What do they think, and how many do we end up actually having?
I think that they've ended up with a figure closer to 30,000. Estimates ranged anywhere from people were taking bets. Some people would say 70, some said 150,000.
So we're simpler than was speculated.
Not necessarily. So then it opens up the question of what is a gene. And one of the things that is really central to many aspects of biology today is what is broadly called functional genomics, which is how do you move from finding information to actually figuring out the functionality of these things in systems, in organisms. And even though there are relatively few, much fewer genes than a lot of people thought, the interactions of those genes with other things are extremely complex.
It's exponential because there are so many possible relationships.
There are so many possible relationships between so many different things. So one of the things that's clearly evolved into the mainstream understanding of biology is the whole question of relationality. So for instance, something like epigenetics is very big in biology, which is simply put gene-environment interactions. Now, so there's much less of a conversation today of a gene for X and much more of a question of, if you think about obesity as a problem, for instance, nobody is saying what is the gene for obesity. They're all talking about what are the various interactions between nutritional environment, socioeconomic factors, and particular expression patterns of genes and their interactions with proteins and the methylation of particular residues or modifications of proteins after they're
created. Right, so it's not like the living room light switch. Well, we want to darken the living room, turn off the light switch.
It is not at all like the living room light switch.
But maybe we thought it might be like that at some point when we didn't really understand.
Well, I mean, again, it's hard to know who the we is because the Genome Project itself was a particular project that was driven by a particular group of people and particular kinds of funding structures. And a story
with an agenda.
With an agenda. And the agenda was to generate this information, and a story had to be told around that agenda.
And wait, you're saying that the agenda was pure science, or the agenda was Merck wanted to have the genome so they could make a lot of gene therapy drugs at some point, speculating on the future?
It was a bit of both. It was not Merck wanting to make a lot of money. It was some biologists who really felt that there would be value to having this information without necessarily knowing in advance what that value would be.
But that's a pure science argument.
It's a pure science argument, but it was a new kind of argument for biology because biology has often been small science, unlike, you know, sort of physics and the Manhattan Project and so on. And so a lot of biologists were resistant to what they saw as the big scientification of biology. And a lot of them said, well, this is simply a technological problem. This isn't a scientific problem. Because for a lot of biologists, the scientific problem was figuring out puzzles, right? And having small research projects that they would give to their PhD students, which would be about a particular, you know, why does this slime mold develop a stalk rather than a spore kind of a question. So there was a lot of reorganization of biology institutionally through the Genome Project.
I see. Right. So it changed biology, you're saying, irrevocably.
I think so.
And therefore, to some extent, biologists' perception of life and the work that they do.
I think that there are ongoing changes in biologists' perception of life, but that's been the case in biology for the last 200 years.
In a way, it's the whole
years.
Purpose of biology, but this is a big step, I think, to break it down to a kind of a machine language level, a code level.
That is a big step, and that's something that's been happening for the last 50 years. So really, molecular biology, whose heyday was the mid-20th century, emerged in quite close conversation with cybernetics, the imagination of living organisms as code. that was a very strong movement in biology that started in the mid-20th century. But what that code means is itself undergoing massive transformation over the last 10 or 15 years. Mm-hmm. So again, it's the living room light switch thing, right? Code is not just bits and bytes that can be understood in terms of those bits and bytes. Code is constantly complex relationships amongst different kinds of entities mm-hmm. and refigurations in the process.
Now, meanwhile, you've been interviewing biologists mm-hmm. to find out what was driving your questions.
You know, when I started the project, nothing was driving questions. When I started the project, it was simply me hanging out as an anthropologist in a lab. I was a biologist by training, and noting that even in the 3 years since I had stopped doing biology, there was so much information that was being downloaded in real time onto computers that were on these scientists' benches. These were not genome scientists. They were doing, they were trying to understand how immune cells work. And I just remarked on this, and I was like, you know, this computer screen becomes actually a part of a lab bench in a way that it wasn't in the early 1990s. And so I got put in touch with other biologists, and this was 1999. It was just before the human genome was sequenced, and so I got thrown into the middle of that.
And so that's when you start to observe, right at that mm-hmm. that threshold point.
That's when I started observing this, and it became a research project.
Got it. And so it's a big page in the history of science.
I think so.
Right. So now you're here investigating possibilities of asking astrologers questions.
Yes.
And you said you had some questions for me.
Well, so I do. I guess. But again, I'm at exactly the same stage where I was when I first started talking to genome scientists, which mm-hmm. is I don't know why I'm there. And when I first started talking to genome scientists, they kept saying, oh, so what do you want from us?
So you're not sure you have the questions, is what you're saying.
I'm sure I don't have the questions. What I'm interested in is, who are you, where do you come from, and what is this thing called astrology that you're thinking about? What does that mean for you? What kind of a knowledge system is it for you, and what kind of a knowledge practice is it for you? And that question can be interpreted however you want it to, but I'd be curious to hear what...
Where should I start? Where am I from, meaning where was I born?
How did you get interested in this? How long have you been doing astrology? What is the nature of your work? Maybe those things.
Yeah, I could sum that up. Mm-hmm. How did I get interested? I think since a pretty young age, I've had an interest in spirituality. I guess that's the word for it, mm-hmm. meaning study of the mind and religion and an affinity for those things. Mm-hmm. And I've been pretty independent minded in terms of my metaphysical values since I was a kid. I've always believed that my perception and not what I was told by someone was the thing to follow up on. Mm-hmm. Not that I didn't choose to mentor myself with people, but rather I knew that I was the one who had to make up my mind. So that that independent-mindedness is helpful to have, I think, mm-hmm. so that astrology does not become a dogma. But we're still a long way from there. Mm-hmm. My parents are both teachers when I was a child, mm-hmm. and my dad was and still is a communications teacher. He's a professor and mm-hmm. teaches communication. So I grew up around a lot of, first of all, appreciation of study, mm-hmm. but also media theory. So as a little kid, I knew who Marshall McLuhan was, mm-hmm. and I knew enough about his ideas to be influenced by them. Hmm. Right, so you know what we're doing now, Marshall McLuhan would love. It's mm-hmm. we're completely independent of any corporate influence, mm-hmm. and doing direct creation of media. Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in the middle of the new media, which is the internet, but mm-hmm. but the content is very similar to talk radio.
Right.
But I have more freedom because I'm not beholden to advertisers. So mm-hmm. so you know, this is kind of like a high fidelity version of a Xerox machine.
Right.
And then I can, you know, any number of people can copy off this file. In any event, mm-hmm. I got a lot of those ideas from early exposure to Marshall McLuhan and other branches of media and communications theory. And so I had always had the idea that that mass communications was something that you could analyze and participate in rather than merely consume. And I thank my dad for that influence, because we were always, he was a doctoral student when I was little, and he was always taping the news. And I really wish I could have these tapes of newscasts. I think it's one of the only things he hasn't saved. He still has his receipt from his first guitar in the 1950s. But I don't think he saved all those tapes of newscasts from the 60s when I was a kid. And in any event, that was the impression that was made. And so I had an orientation on communication media from a very young age, and then also spirituality. That kind of explains what I'm doing today, right? Because I'm interviewing people, and all we're really talking about one person's spiritual perspective compared to the next as we go through these dozens of interviews here. Okay, so I also had an interest in science as a kid, very young. So that's an early influence, and that too feeds into the aspect of astrology that has a scientific affinity, or there's an orientation. It's not, I don't think astrology is a science per se. It's got a lot, it's a blend of art and story and literature and culture more than it is a pure, you know, reductionist science. It's very hard to prove anything with astrology, but you have to have a love of pursuing knowledge and organizing what you learn in some way. So that I had very young age. I had other relatives who were scientists. My uncle was a chemist, and I had an aunt who was a biologist, and so I would get frogs to dissect and lab equipment from Brooklyn College, and I had my big box of lab equipment as a, you know, an 8-year-old, basically. They're bringing me flasks and bullfrogs and dissecting kits and all this stuff. So so I had that personal pursuit of some version of scientific truth that you, whatever you can have when you're 10 or 8, as pursuing scientific truth, I had some of that also. And then pretty young, I went into journalism. That it just seemed to be a natural thing to do. I like to write, and so journalism was really the kind of the foundation of a mode of expression. And pretty early, and got into very quickly into rexograph machines and mimeo machines and Xerox copiers, and while I was, you know, figuring out how to get things in the student newspaper and become editor of the student newspaper, I was also always using duplication machines to put out some kind of an underground publication. So always working the alternative side of things, the alt media and the mainstream media at the same time. Again, also all very young, all stuff I was doing, like I knew what to do when I was, you know, any time between, you know, age of 10 and 14. And so that telling the story, that reveals a certain independent-mindedness and always approaching things with a sense of humor also. You know, when I was a sophomore or something in high school, there was a we reprogrammed our high school every 6 weeks. So every the second week of every cycle, you'd get a little sheet of paper, 11 by 14, 8.5 by 14, sort of long paper with all the classes being offered, and you'd pick the ones for the next semester. So I did a satire on that and did all of a whole other set of classes, and convinced the lady who ran the mimeograph lab in the school to mimeograph them on the same color paper and slip them in. I don't know how I did this. She must have thought it was pretty funny and that she wasn't going to get in any trouble. And so she slipped in all of my spoof into the, you know, 3,000 copies of the same thing, only the real one. So anyway, that's been going on for a long time also. And my career became, well, reporting always with a blend of kind of, you might say, municipal type public affairs reporting, and then investigative. And from a fairly young age, I was doing investigative on environmental issues. And when you start doing that, the topic really is fraud. There's no way to cover environmental issues and not, if you're covering environmental issues and not covering fraud, that's not truthful, because the whole story of the destruction of the environment is the story of fraud committed by all the big players. Dow Chemical, Monsanto, GE, Westinghouse have sustained to this day massive cover-ups of, of their conduct. So my first published article in that field was in 1983. I was 19 when I covered the Love Canal disaster and in Niagara Falls, New York. I was a fairly young managing editor or something of the college magazine and went to Niagara Falls and started investigating what happened, how it happened that, you know, 800 homes and a school were built on not only a chemical waste dump but also the one of the dump sites of the Manhattan Project. That went into the bottom of the Love Canal first. All these boxes from Chicago, basically, and a couple of other places. All the, not all of it, I'm sure. But a lot of it got buried at Los Alamos and places. But a bunch of it went. And then they put all this toluene and PCBs and dioxin and all that stuff piled on top of it. Then they put a school on top of that. And then 800 homes around that. So that was sort of a early radicalizing experience, particularly on the issue of environmental toxins. And then when I was in my last year of university, Chernobyl happened. And for whatever reason, I found this to be a personally devastating experience of knowing that that a nuclear power plant was in a total meltdown. Now, my father had joined the nuclear industry in the late 1970s, right after Three Mile Island happened. And he was working for a, so this is a bit before I go to university and start doing this. So while I'm in high school, my father gets a job with a company called Ready Communications. Ready Communications was one of the companies that was hired by, I'm not sure which of the players in the Three Mile Island, there were three, the power company and the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and one other one. So my dad's a consultant on the public relations end of the cleanup of Three Mile Island. And my dad thinks he's a conservative and you know, he's pro-nuclear and all that. But without realizing what he was doing, he was teaching me the rudiments of investigative reporting. So while I'm in high school, I'm learning what is a story and what is a public relations person defending them against when defending themselves and their client against when they're defending themselves against reporting, accurate reporting. So I understood what a story was, and he said, well, you know, the reason the Three Mile Island became a story was that the three players, Metropolitan Edison, the nuclear plant itself, Three Mile Island, and the NRC, were all giving different versions of the story. So he was trying to say, when you're the PR guy, make sure that all everyone has the same talking points. What I heard was, go forth into the world and look for inconsistencies in the versions of the same story, because that's when you know you have a story. So this is the kind of the apple not falling far from the tree, but in a slightly different form than he may have intended. And but in any event, he's got that kind of Aquarian objectivity, that sort of perverse, I still haven't wrapped my head around why he thinks he's a conservative, but that's actually what he thinks he is. And when he was a teacher at professor at Pace College, back when it was Pace College back in the day, Students for a Democratic Society didn't have a faculty advisor because the campus was too conservative. And he said, well, I'll be the faculty advisor. I don't care what you think. You just need somebody to let you into your room after. And they said, no, we can't have a conservative be the faculty advisor for Students for a Democratic Society, which is when I think of my dad offering to be the faculty advisor for SDS on a college campus in the 60s. That's pretty funny. So that's an Aquarian for you, though, which he's got a lot of Aquarius. He's got Sun and Moon, a couple of other things in Aquarius. So, anyway, I go to college, and he gets his job for consulting on Three Mile Island, and I'm learning the rudiments of investigative reporting. So this is all feeding into a kind of a critical thinking mentality, but somehow at some point I don't have any fear of telling the truth. This is the thing I think that stops a lot of people, that for some reason I just feel inoculated. that someone's going to harm me, or if they do, that it always plays back into my hands anyway. I figured that one out a long time ago also. So I begin this career as a journalist, and then Chernobyl happens, and now I have an understanding of nuclear issues when Chernobyl happens, but I'm not indoctrinated. I just understand what the issues are, and this really shapes me in a way. And I'm going through a spiritual awakening at the time, and I'm graduating from university, and shortly after graduating, I get a job working for a municipal newspaper in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. Kind of a classy, well-written municipal paper called the Echo Sentinel, and I was assigned to cover the town of Warren, New Jersey.
Okay.
So I'm out of college, and now I'm no longer, you know, the most famous journalist on campus. Now I'm working covering Warren Township, and I'm covering the sewage authority, learning about the underground city of pipes, that's the independent sewage authority and the township committee and the planning board. And throughout all this, I've had an involvement in politics, always working on election campaigns and taking a direct role. Mm-hmm. That continued. You know, I kept an interest in politics after I graduated. But my editor of that newspaper was an astrologer. She happened to be an astrologer by the name of Flo Higgins, still alive. She's still living down in South Jersey in her 80s. And so when I took my first job as a municipal reporter, there was an astrology calendar hanging over my desk. Now, I did not plan this. I knew that she was an astrologer, but I did not know what that meant. And when I started work, I started to find out what it meant, which really meant that she would terrorize the company with, assertions of what was going to happen when Mercury went retrograde.
Right.
And, you know, Saturn was square the sun, really sun square Saturn. She would say Saturn square the sun, and we had to work harder because Saturn was going to be square the sun and all this stuff. And we were hapless. We had no idea. we were young college grads in the 1980s who were sitting there having to type out like 80 column inches a week, which is a lot. To write, and we were being paid, I think my paycheck was like $190 a week. I don't know how I even, I guess things were a little bit cheaper back then. And so as I'm starting my professional journalism career in a newspaper office, I'm exposed to astrology.
Right.
And she cast my chart and told me a little bit about it, and I bought tarot cards and started getting into tarot cards, but I still was not interested in astrology. I still hadn't crossed the threshold of astrology being a useful thing. I couldn't see the use of it yet. And then I begin a long, illustrious career as an independent investigative reporter. I start my own company. I'm working as a freelance writer for places like Sierra Magazine and The Village Voice and more quirky stuff like Lies of Our Times. I wrote some of my best stuff for an old thing called Lies of Our Times, published by the people who put out Covert Action Quarterly, the only journal that covers the CIA. And so I was doing news analysis, like I was analyzing New York Times stories, which is one of the things Lies of Our Times did. Basically, that was the pun of Lies of Our Times, was that our job was to dismantle the New York Times and show their bias. But still had no demonstration that astrology was useful. Until someone said, "Well, you like this stuff. You like reading tarot cards. You should read the New York Post horoscope. You should really check out what's going on there." So that was written by a guy named Patrick Walker, and for the next few years, I checked the New York Post horoscope every day, and after a while, was so astonished at how relevant and accurate that it was, that I couldn't stand it anymore and had to figure out how he did it. So I bought an ephemeris. I went on my 30th birthday to a bookstore in my neighborhood that had the Rosicrucian ephemeris, and that was the day that I had my deposition taken by the state attorney general. I had sued New York State in a conflict over my right to report on a certain toxins issue. That day was the day that I had my deposition taken, which means you're subjected to a whole day of a fishing trip of any questions. And I left the deposition at about 5 o'clock, and with my girlfriend just strolled over off the campus and to the esoteric bookstore called Esoterica, actually, in New Paltz, and bought an ephemeris. Mm-hmm. And then for the next 6 months or so, hacked the New York Post horoscope using an ephemeris. Mm. That's how I learned astrology, basically. Huh. And then started doing more sophisticated forms of, you know, people started recommending books, and I started meeting teachers, and very early on heard about Chiron and what was then a fairly new book on Pluto, Evolutionary Journey of the Soul, and was turned on to all of the best astrology books of the day mm-hmm. by people who knew what they were talking about. And 1 year later, I had reached a point where I knew that reporting on toxins and science fraud was not getting through to people. Mm-hmm. It seems to be more than most people can stand, or it certainly was at the time. And in a way, there still is a relevancy issue. You know, why should we care about the history of any one chemical when everything gives you cancer anyway? You know, right. That's the thinking. So I was curious about that, and also very frustrated by the fact that people didn't seem to care that their dorm rooms were contaminated with dioxin from a known incident, and I went from that story to documenting the global history of PCBs going back to the late 1890s. My earliest report of the knowledge of toxicity comes out of the GE files, and that dates to 1899 on a chemicals similar to PCBs. But really, the story starts in 29 when Monsanto buys Swan Chemical on the patent for PCBs and starts to contaminate the entire world. Mm-hmm. And I am the journalist who put that whole story together. It's only been done once. Every other story that's been done is based on my story. That was on the cover of Sierra magazine. And right when that came out, I won my lawsuit. I got the story onto the cover of Sierra magazine. The New York Times did a second story about my work because I won a lawsuit against New York State, which basically doesn't happen except in my case, and rarely. You just don't really hear about it. You know, you have to really be sent to jail for 20 years. Even then, it's verges on impossible. So, mm-hmm. I realized that mode, that rhetorical mode of talking about toxins, was not getting through to people. Mm-hmm. They didn't seem to care, and I could not understand why they didn't care. It was very frustrating to me, as someone to whom the truth matters. Mm-hmm. And so I knew I needed to do something else. I was at my Saturn return. That was a convenient jump-off point. And one day, basically, I just sort of declared myself an astrologer and started doing it. Mm-hmm. And I had been taught well enough by people who knew what they were doing, and I had a really good therapist, and I learned some basic maneuvers of how to work with a person. And that is in the mid-1990s. I started my column in April or March or something of 1995. Mm-hmm. And have been writing it now for 17 years. Hmm. And now it's a company that supports a staff and, a creative team. Mm-hmm. And we've injected the internet, which became a very convenient way to work with the public and to publish in an alternative field. So for me, with my background in Rexo machines and Mimeo machines and Xerox mm-hmm. machines, the internet became the best Mimeo machine ever. Mm-hmm. And it's in color. And you can put video and audio on it. I'm not that big into video. I like audio, in case anybody hasn't noticed that yet. Mm. And that's more or less led to where we are now.
Right.
Though what I've done that I think is interesting and fairly unique is I don't know of any accredited investigative journalist with their bona fides, with mm-hmm. their track record and, you know, my multiple accreditations by agencies around the world that in concept and then in reality, but you always need a little bit of both, makes me a bona fide investigative reporter who then became an astrologer. And what I did was I quickly brought in the whole ethos of investigative reporting mm-hmm. into astrology and applied a journalistic model to astrology, or put astrology into a journalistic framework, which included and includes a horoscope column, but also news reporting through the framework of astrology, and not the kind that you see sometimes where it's just a superficial recitation of the event and then a look at the chart, but rather in-depth reporting. So we've done pieces on the history of nuclear power and in-depth pieces on 9/11 and, you know, pieces that go way beyond what you would ever expect an astrology website or astrology writer to cover with a, you know, there's fact checkers on our staff. We're, you know, we're working to the standards of professional investigative journalism, in which doesn't really exist anymore. I mean, it's sort of a lost art. I mean, there's most publications would, if they told the truth, would tell you that investigative reporting goes against their mission, because it takes a long time and it's very expensive and it's deep and you risk people not knowing and not caring.
Right.
But what I found was if I put it in an astrological context, which both would personalize it and tell the transpersonal story on the long arc of time, looking at the outer planet transits and doing the charts of hundreds of news events over the years, that there was a different kind of interest. That it was so there's something about that combination that has that's able to speak to people in a way differently than reporting without that portal into the human dimension. So what Planet Waves does, which grew out of the horoscope, and Planet Waves is founded in 1998, and though I've been doing the horoscope for about 3 years before that for different places and writing for Rob Brezhne's website and writing for a number of other websites as well as having my own, is that there is a wider cultural context that I can use astrology to point out and bring through the meaning as well as reach people in a personal way. And what distinguishes Planet Waves as a journalistic style is that there is always relevance and a mode of participation. If I challenge you to read any story in any newspaper, you know, except about the weather, and tell me what that has to do with you.
Right.
Now, I'm not saying that everything has to be about your ego, but I'm just merely talking about relevance. For example, 99% of articles about the economy don't affect your ability to spend.
Right.
When you needed to know about the subprime mortgage crisis, you didn't because it wasn't in the newspaper. So there's a lack of relevance. And by the time you're being foreclosed, if you are, what difference does it make if you're reading it in the newspaper? It's still irrelevant.
Right.
So the relevancy piece of journalism is the piece that's not, you know, they try to answer it in the question why, who, what, where, when, why. But I would add a sixth criteria for what is the relevance to this community or to this person. And so the relevance that Planet Waves brings to the conversation is what you could think of as an evolutionary relevance and opening up at least an understanding of the world in a way that goes in deeper than, you know, something explaining a congressional hearing in the New York Times. I mean, that really doesn't tell you that much about how the world works.
Right.
The politics is rarely revealed for what it is. There's no one looking at the meta level. So we, with astrology, I've been able to explain the meta level, the larger confluence of events, as well as explain the personal juncture that coincides with the historical juncture, and spend a lot of time working at that intersection, explaining and illustrating and demonstrating that intersection. So, for example, studying the motives of newsmakers. When you look at the chart of an Obama, that's different than asking, is Obama going to be president, and why can't he get over on the Republicans and so forth like that. So it's possible to go deeper and then through that keep a focus on a human dimension. So that's kind of more than a few words.
It's terrific.
A story of at least one person's evolution, mm-hmm. you know, through careers that seem very divergent.
Right.
But there's a lot of commonality between investigative reporting and astrology, including what to do with all the data.
Mm.
Most in if you've taken 2 years to do an investigative story, you only have a few thousand words to tell the story. You're not going to write a book. You leave out most of what you know. You're only choosing representative salient facts that prove the point that you're making. Even in a series of articles, there's a relatively limited space that you have. So there's what to do with all the data. There's how to work with pattern recognition. There is what is germane.
Mm-hmm.
What is the purpose of the work? And all of those questions become relevant in astrology, because there's, at least the way I do astrology, working with more than 100 points.
Mm-hmm.
You know, trans-Neptunian objects, asteroids, centaurs, planets, hypothetical points, and so forth. There's a question of what you do with all this data. How
right.
do you make this relevant? And pattern recognition, which
mm-hmm.
I think astrology in many ways is the art of pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could keep listing things that investigative reporting and astrology have in common. You have to have an independent intellect. There's an ethics involved. You're actually using power.
Mm-hmm.
I could long list of parallels between the two
sure.
in a structural and ethical framework that you might not think were there.
Hmm.
And my background is a kind of, I'm not really a skeptic, but when you cover fraud,
mm-hmm.
you realize people lie, and they have motives to lie, and their cover-ups can be vast. And even though people like to say this is conspiracy theory, you know, there's 8 separate statutes against conspiracy in the state of New York, just state law. That doesn't even include federal law. There's, you know, all these different degrees and types and subchapters of conspiracy. If there were not conspiracies, there wouldn't be 8 separate statutes in just on the New York state law book. So there's obviously a conspiracy issue, and it really takes discipline to be able to identify the elements of that and demonstrate it to a reasonable person in a grounded way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I took that skill and brought that to astrology.
Mm.
How do you make the case that this aspect is connected with this event?
Right.
And so that takes a... there's an art of understatement involved, I think, and there is understanding logic and reasoning process and having connection points. And so what I've done basically over the last 15 years or so is invent a genre of journalism that I feel is a necessary step in journalism, which is sort of the running narrative of what's happening in the world, but we're now entering, have long since entered, but we're now entering even more so a phase where we need that article about the contaminated dorm room, which in this case would be, in the case of the world, would be fracking or Fukushima.
Mm-hmm.
We need larger context, I think, to have that be relevant, and we need to see the relevance. And we need the human dimension, and we need a spiritual dimension to this coverage. We need to understand the motives and the ethics involved,
mm-hmm.
and the lack thereof sometimes. And so I think that in the era of history that we're going into, in terms of the need for conveying life-giving information,
mm-hmm.
and the need for understanding why things happen and what we can do about them, that we do need a new form of journalism that is actually relevant, that does actually have personal contact point, that does work with the equation that the fruit of knowledge is action, and that is not, I hate the word disempowering, but really when you read an article in the New York Times, one of the first things you feel is helpless usually.
Right.
You can't do anything about that. You read about all this crime and you hear about all these bankers who didn't get arrested. They're all collecting multi-million dollar bonuses while people are getting kicked out of their house next to you, and maybe you are getting kicked out of your house. And so to get past this, we need a new way to convey information and to organize knowledge and to understand what is so. So there's a lot of epistemology in astrology. Really, a good astrologer has to be an epistemologist, which means the study of how we know what we know. And there has to be an element of philosophy involved, because philosophy is their ideas to live by. Their ideas to offer insight into, you know, human experience. And, you know, a good news story gives that, but not nearly enough to really make a difference with it. And so I think that we're being depleted by most of what we call news. Even the best journalists don't. I mean, I think one of the best storytellers on the air right now is Rachel Maddow. And though I've caught her at having a couple of problems consistently, I think she's a very brilliant political reporter, and I love her perspective. And I don't think she necessarily views her job as to inspire anyone to action any more than by giving them analysis. But the best you get with the best journalist on TV is analysis. And her analysis is brilliant. And one thing that I feel a kinship with Maddow about is that her love of context. That she's very good at putting the story into context. She doesn't just tell you what Dick Cheney said. She'll do a 10-minute segment reminding you of everything Dick Cheney has said since he was a congressman. Which is beautiful, because no one else is doing it, and it is great source material. I mean, the Rachel Maddow show is almost like a set of notes for me to work from to do what I do. So I trust most of her fact-checking and her ability to reconstruct what happened, but then there's the action piece, the relevancy piece, the ethics, you know, the personal ethics piece, where your involvement is, that I think, and she's the cream of the crop, and still I think it does not help that much. I think it can feed cynicism, and the only reason it doesn't is because she's pretty friendly about it, I think, and she takes the whole thing with a sense of humor. I mean, she's as funny as Jon Stewart, I think, and notably, it's Jon Stewart and Steve Colbert, I think, who are doing the best job at delivering the news. No matter what they might say, the medium of satire is one of the best ways to make a point in a way that people get and don't feel crushed by.
Yeah.
You know, Colbert is bigger than these idiots. And so he's knocking them down to size. He's not taking any shit from them, including Bush and Cheney and the entire National Press Corps themselves when he did his ambush on them in 2006, I think, or 2007, at the White House Correspondents' Dinner. So that bigger than is something we get from astrology also, that there's a larger context. Pluto's been in Capricorn before. When was that? That was the American Revolution. And so forth. Neptune's been in Pisces before. What was that? That was the Civil War. That was the breakup of the Union. So we have the American Revolution toward the end of Pluto and Capricorn. We have the Civil War toward the end of Neptune and Pisces last time. Now they're both back. And there's a number of astrologers who are pretty sure that certainly the possibility of a breakup of the American Union is certainly possible. Some we couldn't see it now, but then there's a lot of things that we can't see now that happen the next day. The breakup of the Soviet Union, for example. Who could see that coming? So, you know. So there again is a long answer to your question. But there you go.
This is utterly fascinating. This is great stuff. And again, not anything that I could have
predicted.
A question, because this is really interesting.
Awesome. Well, glad to be of a little bit of help and to, you know, once again tell these stories in a maybe a slightly different way than I have. As time goes on, I'm realizing my dad's influence on me. In some ways, we're, you know, so different in terms of spiritual orientation and all that, but we have certain very important things in common, like an inherent humanitarianism. I mean, he's one of these conservatives. No matter how conservative he is, he really believes that helping people is the right thing to do. So, we have a connection through St. Francis. That's an important one. He even went bald in the shape that monks shaved their head. Franciscan monks. It's pretty funny. And thankfully, I'm not going bald that way, but I'm St. Francis is a good friend of mine. And then my dad is a great fan of my satires. It is a place where there's no division in philosophy. Once I handed him a binder book of I would love to have this thing again. I hope I know where it is. Many of my previous spoofs of things. I'll basically anything that can be spoofed, I will make a spoof of it. I will do a knockoff of it and have fun with that. And I remember him laughing uncontrollably for like an hour and a half reading through this thing, and I thought, well, you know, he really understands me on this level. You know, we have the exact same sense of humor. So it's interesting that I'm a lover of understanding the common ground between people who seem to be so different. And I have a fetish for conservatives that way. I want to know, because, you know, I'm kind of, if most people would think I'm to the left of Che Guevara, but I take a conservative approach to my revolutionary activities. And I'm always curious about what the common ground is with people who consider themselves conservatives. I'm always trying to figure out what they're thinking and how they made their conclusion. Sadly, I'm forced to tell you that they often haven't thought things through very well, and their conclusions are generally unsupportable. But when you love someone, you love them, and you can overlook that, and you know, you can always just go back to whatever, sending them pictures of things or whatever, you know. You have in common. And I think astrologers do need to be broad-minded. I mean, we're handling all kinds of people from all kinds of walks of life in all kinds of situations. And even within people whose position you sort of agree with, there's possibility for judgment. And really, once an astrologer has made a determination that working with the person is ethically sound, that it's okay to work with them, they're not trying to, you know, kill someone or rob something or whatever the ethical basis might be, that it's crucial to let them figure out what they want, figure out what the right thing is for them. And then there's a counseling role where, you know, there's a sort of an ethics counselor that astrology can have and something of a timing counselor. Is this the appropriate time for that? But still, as much as possible, it needs to be within the client's value system.
Right.
And that takes being open-minded, and it takes being able to understand what motivates that person sitting there with you. So a lot of what I do with people is I work to figure out what's motivating them, figure out who they are and how their life has gone, and as best I can, why it's gone that way. So it does take a love of people to do most forms of astrology.
Right.
You know, the understanding of how quirky and contradictory people can be.
Yeah.
So
this is great. So maybe one more question that's sort of vague and tangential, but which could be an opening for you to ask back in any way, which is, if you were me, where would you go with this? Because one of the things that, you know, one of the reasons why your story is so fascinating for me, for instance, is that it's an unpredictable entry point and that these stories really do matter. So there isn't already, for real people, there isn't already a set of definitional entry points into why they care about something, whether that be astrology or anything else. And this is the value of an anthropological perspective, because it gets into things starting with the stories rather than with the hypotheses. So I'm not interested in this project in terms of, is astrology true or not? I'm not interested in that sort of framing of it. I'm interested in it in terms of the fact that the world is complicated and the world is interesting, and this is something that people do and devote themselves to and are interested in.
And it's a career that's not on the career book. There's no guidance counselor probably ever in the history of at least our country.
Sure.
India, different story. England, right on the line, who said, I think that you should be an astrologer. You know, they never said fireman, electrician, nurse, lawyer, astrologer.
Right.
Not in the United States.
Right.
So everyone has found it through some sort of extracurricular method. Mm-hmm. And I think that the transition point from the prior career is a good one. And then I think that may inherently lend itself to statements about the early roots of the elements of astrology in their childhood.
Right.
There seem to be two kinds of astrologers. There are the ones who they sort of woke up at 5 years old, and even among American astrologers, mm-hmm. woke up fairly young and were, you know, staring at the stars and looking at, you know, celestial things, and were drawn to that. And there are the ones who seem to have discovered it later in life. I'm a later in life person. In my late 20s and early 30s, that's fairly old compared to the people who, you know, like my friend Priya, who's Indian, who was asking for astrology books for Christmas when she was seven, that kind of thing. Right? I didn't have that. I had, again, no interest in it, didn't read the horoscopes, didn't care. So that transition, I think, is going to tell you a lot about the values influencing the work that they do. And included in my stuff, I told you something about how I think I know what I know, which is I applied the standards of another profession, mm-hmm. being one of the young people who is influenced by Woodward and Bernstein.
Right.
Really, but, you know, because that right there, 72, they're doing their work in 72, 73, 74. I'm like 9, 10, 11, 8, 9, 10 years old, right? So I'm of that generation of people who was called into journalism because it was shown to be relevant. Mm-hmm. So I brought that platform to astrology as a way of establishing the factual basis of any one story.
Right.
But everyone has their own method of establishing the factual basis of what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And some people it's stronger with a tighter mesh, and for some it's fairly wide and sloppy and loose, and
right.
all kinds of reasoning processes fall through the sieve. So I don't know how you would guide them into a description of epistemology.
Right.
And I know that for what you're doing, specific questions are not always helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Because you want to give people room, you want to give them enough rope, basically, to say what's going on and not impose your cultural framework
right.
on the savages.
Mm-hmm.
Right, so we're...
yes.
Here we are. Oh, you mean you're not Christian? Ooh, that's so strange. We ought to get a missionary here.
Exactly.
So, you know...
Yeah.
Though I think that a lot of astrologers are conscious of their... spiritual underpinnings. I think you'll hear that one a fair amount. That
right.
you know, just as Martin Luther tried to do, we're the ones who want to go directly to God. We don't want to have to go through the Pope.
Right.
So that's what we do. Dial in the celestial order directly, you know, through whatever tools, the ephemeris and the charting software and reasoning process. So there you have it.
Splendid.
All right, so thank you.
Thank you so much.
After all these interviews, I finally got to give one. So we're gonna put this up as Anthropologist Interviews Eric Francis.
Perfect.
All righty, so let's see who's next. Gonna do financial astrology next. And then my friend Donna Woodwell, who's been sending me lots of guests. She's a fun little troublemaker. He's gonna send somebody called Heather Horton, who I'm supposed to like. I don't know. And Genevieve Hathaway is taking a picture of me right now. All right, so we will see you with the next installment in this long and fun continuing coverage of the United Astrology Conference in not St. Louis, but New Orleans. And we're finishing this one at 12:20 on Saturday, the 26th. Catch you next time.